Well, our jet set traveler, Peter Majors, back home in Cape Town, just. So, I suppose if he stumbles over his words a little this week, we will be able to forgive him for sure. But knowing him, he certainly won't. He won't be doing that. We got lots to talk about on this week's edition of Mining Web Weekly. So just tell me about your travels coming back from the West Coast. So you leave Idaho at what time?
I left Idaho at 6:30 in the morning, and I got to Spokane, Washington at about just before 8 o'clock, probably 10 to 8. So it took an hour, 20 minutes. Normally, I can fly Spokane, Atlanta, Cape Town. But this time, it didn't work out. I had to go Spokane, Salt Lake City, Atlanta, Cape Town. But still, it was literally under 25 hours, Alec, and that's a record. And going over there, I made it in about 24 and a half. Traditionally, it always took about 33, 34 hours. You always had a long layover, either in Amsterdam or taking Emirates or Qatar. You'd always get an 8 or 9 hour layover there. But with Delta, it's quick. And you know, there's a big difference between 24 hours and 32. You know, you look, I do have jet lag. Woke up at 2:30 in the morning, couldn't get back to sleep. So I've been working since 2:30, but the last couple hours, I'm ready to hit it for a bit. So it does take a couple days to adjust. You need sleep with darkness, and you got to turn both your cell phones off. You can't keep having the cell phones ringing for pseudo important messages.
And it is about the worst part of the world for a South African to have a business partnership or a business operation. It's like the other end, almost, if you were to drill through the core.
You're right. You'll come up in my backyard. You're exactly right. My backyard in Cape Town, if I went straight through, I'd come up my backyard in Idaho.
Anyway, let's talk about the exciting news that there has been in the on the mining scene in the past week. And of course, next week, we're going to be at the Joburg Mining Indaba. So we'll be bumping into, I suppose, quite a lot of your old friends, Peter. You I suppose, go to an event like that and to spend a lot of time shaking hands.
It's a heck of a reunion, Alec. And they try to contain it at 500 people. And I think I know about a third of them. And I probably recognize close to another third. So this will be my 10th or 11th Joburg Indaba. I think I only missed one or two during COVID. You know, I was sitting here in Cape Town and it was over the internet. But I think I've made every live one they've had except maybe one. And they are really good. I think you'll see that. This is a South African mining Indaba. And yes, they'll talk about Namibia a bit, Botswana a bit. But I would say 70 to 80% are going to be on South African. And the government last year had a decent delegation that stayed all 3 days. That meant Gwede Montash was there off and on for 3 days. And that was a record because half the time he doesn't even show. And the other half, when he does show, it's zoom in and zoom out for his talk. But I've got to give Gwede credit. He was there a lot of the time, all 3 days.
Well, my friend Bernard Swanepoel used to ask me to help him, and I'd facilitate a session or two, but obviously I've fallen right off the list there. We've got far more important people, far better to do that. But I haven't been to a mining Indaba for some years, so really looking forward to getting back and talking, maybe even to a couple of those that we're going to be starting off our conversation with this week. Natasha Viljoen, who's now been formally signed, sealed, delivered as the CEO of the biggest gold company in the world, Newmont. And who knows, Mark Bristow, might he make an appearance having just left Barrick? I suppose he's got a bit of time on his hands now, having left with immediate effect, a big shock that came through this week.
Yeah, I'd love to see them both there. And Natasha's been to a few of them, and Mark's been, I think, to a few. He was there a couple years ago to receive an important person award. They give out two every Indaba. And yeah, it's, what is he? I think he's 66, 67 now.
66, yeah.
Yeah, and he had planned on retiring in 2 years at Berry, but this was a shock. This was a real jolt to me, and I haven't heard a great explanation. You know, people are saying, well, he didn't do enough mergers and acquisitions. Alec, I've heard that the opposite so often. Usually when mining executives do a bad deal, a blatantly bad deal, their retort is always, well, I have to do that because you guys want me to, or the shareholders they hired me to do these deals. And I've never believed that story. They always use that, but now I'm hearing it and I'm thinking, well, hell, here's the guy who gets asked to leave because he didn't do enough M&A deals. You know, usually they do too many and you want them to leave because the more they do, the worse the company performs. But this decision, I think, was made a few months ago, because if you look at the price of Barrick just the last 2 to 3 months, I think it's more than doubled or close to doubled. So, but look at it 2 to 3 months ago, Alec. It was down about 80% from its high of about 12, 14 years ago. And it was just a relentless downhill trend. Now, Mark's only been there not even 7 years, but the trend continued with Mark there. And you say maybe it needs 2 or 3, maybe 4 years to clean it up and start outperforming. But yeah, 7 years. Okay. I'm talking underperforming the gold price. It's grossly underperformed the gold price, which probably makes David Melville and you pretty happy that you were buying gold instead of a share. And I think we've agreed not many of these gold companies have outperformed the gold price over time. And Barrick definitely hasn't. And yes, it's really outperformed gold the last 2 or 3 months. But when you look at over 5 years, 10 and 15, geez, it's got to go up another fivefold to get where it was back in 2007. It has outperformed Newmont, though, by about 20% the last 5 years. And Newmont's its twin brother as far as the largest gold producers in the world. They both do very close to, I think, is it 4 million ounces each a year that they're, yeah. So Newmont's been probably the worst performing of all. So they were definitely due for a new CEO. And good place to start, South African CEOs, right? Maybe.
But the Mark Bristow story is really interesting because, and you would be able to tell it better than most, he started in the Brett Kebble stable and despite the Kebbles made a roaring success with Randgold Resources.
He did. And I used to sarcastically say, Mark's a darn good CEO. He's a very good geologist, a very good CEO, but it didn't come overnight. You know, we spent a couple billion dollars training Mark back in the 90s. So that, and yeah, there was do I call it disasters? You know, he started a lot of mines, bought some mines, started them, but it just looked like nothing could go right in the 90s. All right, that's against a backdrop of a falling gold price. And so that can cloud it. But by the new millennium, Mark was ready. His company was ready for this gold price increase. And by 2002, I think few people doubted he was probably the best CEO, certainly in Africa, of all the others. And back then, he had a lot of competition. You know, AngloGold had good people. Goldfields had good people, JCI. But Mark had built mines from scratch. That was his forte. And Mark started gold mining in Mali. He made Mali into the gold producer it is today. And that really hurts to see the government beating up on Barrick the most, which is like beating up on Mark Bristow the most. And here's the guy that made Mali what it was. And he He's got the two biggest mines there. And well, I guess that's why they're hitting him with the biggest unpaid tax bill, they say. But I'm really cynical when these third world countries come up with underpayment of taxes. These are all listed companies. They're pretty thoroughly investigated by all the analysts, by all the fund managers, and by all the shareholders that buy shares in them. So there's always some advisor that can go up to these junta-run countries and saying, hey, I can show you a dozen ways these big mines are screwing you over. But it's always behind the scenes. Sometimes these consultants are known. Sometimes they're faceless. But they put ideas in the government ministers or the president's head, and they don't know enough. You know, we discussed this, I think, your last program. How much do our government ministers know about the industries they're supposed to be nurturing and assisting instead of pounding into the ground, exploiting, pillaging them? Most of them don't have a clue. And without a doubt, this military junta running Mali, they don't have a clue how these mines work. They don't have a clue how the investment bit works, tax deductions, what's a fair tax. They don't have a clue, and they don't want to know. They just take hostages, make demands, and it looked like there's very little room for negotiation. You know, Mark tried negotiating for the last 2 years with him, and he's the last holdout. The others just paid. You know, the smaller ones, they just paid really quick. They just rolled over. And then that starts making the country's leaders say, oh, well, maybe we were right. You know, they often forget, or they confuse kidnapping and hostage taking with unpaid taxes. You know, you're going to pay to get your men free, whether you're Ross Perot breaking your men out of Iran during the revolution back in 1980, or if you're CEO today and your executives are being kidnapped or held hostage. It's difficult. And I see the U.S. is talking about, oh, we're willing to assist Mali if we can secure the metals we need. Well, it would be good if we had some Trump intervention in Mali right now. And it can start by saying, hey, you know, Barrick's an American company here, and you're holding four of its management hostage, and you're saying they underpaid, but can we go to court and see if they underpaid in tax? You know, who's decided this? Was it a unilateral decision by yourself, by your consultant? It's difficult being a gold mine manager. Being a mine manager is difficult.
Peter, is there any way that what happened there has had anything to do with Mark's departure?
Yeah, I would say that's a possibility. They could say, Mark, the other company settled much quicker than you. You've dragged it out. It's affecting our share price. It's affecting our relationship with the government. You know, there could have been some behind-the-scenes talks between the chairman or some representative of the company with some representative in the government. You know, government could have put an idea in someone's ear, hey, we could settle this a lot easier, quicker, and cheaper if there's somebody besides Mark. I would find it hard to believe that they got a personal axe to grind with Mark, because as I just said earlier, that guy's done more for that country than probably any businessman in existence.
But a military junta wouldn't care of it. If you've done a military takeover, who cares? Who's done anything for you? You have the power. You want the money. This guy is holding out. Everybody else is caved. So perhaps his ethics and his integrity and his morality is the reason why Mark Bristow is not there anymore. And perhaps the lack of ethics and integrity and morality of the board of directors is part of it. I'm just floating or flying a kite. No,
These are important questions, Alec. I don't know how much Mark will blab. You know, after he's out, maybe he's got to sign something to say this was all intercompany business and I'm not allowed, but hopefully it gets out, you know, and hopefully these countries. But as you say, when you get a military junta that just pops in there out of nowhere, they don't care about the history of the person or the company that built the place. Hell, we've had that problem in this country, huh? We've seen how this government, that's supposed to be a little bit better than a military junta, we've seen how they treated the companies and the people that did the most for this country. And if I look at Neil Froneman, what he went through in Sabania, you know, with his start of Uranium One and Gold One, I don't think anybody has saved more jobs in this country than Neil Froneman, you know, taking the assets that Anglos was going to close, taking over Lawnmen that was going to close. And look what he did with those assets. The gold mines, you know, Goldfields was going to be closing a lot more of those shafts. Beatrix, you know, Neil's responsible for probably 75,000 well-paid quality jobs being maintained. Bernard Swanepoel, putting together all those mines that were going to close and making Harmony. You know, Harmony's day is off the fruits of Bernard's hard work all in the new millennium. But yeah, did our government treat Bernard, did the union treat Bernard and Neil with any kind of respect or thanks? Maybe the last few years, but boy, they gave him a lot of rough decades.
So I guess when it gets back to the Barrick story, we will know if there's a quick settlement now that is done between Barrick and the Mali military junta, who, remember, have got into power through a coup. So that has got to be waving big flags. I see there have been reports now of Congo wanting to bring more investors in, develop more of their gold assets. And then, was it today or yesterday, they have announced that their former president has been sentenced to death in absentia. So at least he isn't going to be executed immediately. But my goodness, if you are a long-term investor, you've got to be looking at Mali and looking at DRC and saying, perhaps there's an easier way to, a safer place to put my money.
Jeez, it's got to be. And I know microchips are risky, software's risky, but geez, do they have half or a third of the hassles that mining companies have in these countries, Alec? I just don't believe they do. I know they'll tell us all the problems they have, but these are real life. These are life and death problems that mining companies have in third world countries.
So what happens now to the international mining community when they have a look at a place like the DRC? Lots of rich resources that are sitting there, that it's almost like a treasure chest of opportunity, but with the overhang of governance that can, change with the wind.
You know, it's interesting how it does change, how mining companies' attitudes change in those countries. You know, Mali, Ghana, Zambia, and the DRC. Because I've just heard horror stories from the time I was old enough to read and write. And yet, it's kind of cyclical. Some mining companies will want to get out. There'll be low investment, and then a bunch of companies will get in. There'll be high investment. It's kind of cyclical. The one country that stands out that it's not cyclical, that it's secular, is our home country right here, Alec. There's just been a downward trend in mining investment in this country, almost unbroken since before 2000. And it's odd. We always say, geez, the DRC, the government's much more unstable, the legislation changing. I remember a couple of Ndabas, all the big execs from Robert Friedland, Mark Bristow, some of the others, Anglo Gold. They all had to catch a plane all of a sudden because word was out that Congo was now nationalizing another 25, 30% after they already had 25, 30%. And all the execs had to fly up there. And yet, look how many tens of billions of dollars have gone into the Congo in the last 20 years to build gold mines and copper mines. And in this country, has 1 cent come into this country in the last 20 years to build a copper mine or a gold mine? So if that's not a wake-up call for our guys in Pretoria, that's how bad they've put the image of South Africa out to the investment committee, that places like Mali, Ghana, DRC are getting tens of billions, even with kidnappings, confiscation, change in legislation. All those added together have not been as bad is what our government has done to our mining industry here. We are a real polecat. We are literally down there with North Korea.
Why?
Well, maybe I shouldn't give government all the credit. You know, our unions here were a lot worse than the unions in those other countries. But combined with our infrastructure falling and getting worse, and see, it's the trend that's more important than where you're at. You can take a lot of pain if you see the trend is going up if you just hold on. But you take a lot less pain if you see the trend is going to get worse and you're going to have to take more and more pain and there's no blue sky. So when those governments do have a coup or an election, they automatically get the benefit of the doubt. And if they make some positive changes to the legislation, that's a positive alteration in your trend. But here, have we seen any positive changes in our mining legislation? It's just compounded going down, down, worse, worse. Has our railways and our power plants gotten better the last 20 years? No, they're getting worse, worse, worse. So they're not getting much better in the Congo or Zambia or Mali or Ghana, but they are getting better. And when they get another president, sometimes he'll rescind a lot of the bad mining legislation. But we just haven't had that. We've had the same party in charge for 30 years. There's no rescinding of any of the bad mining legislation. And the unions, I can't pick on now, but they still did untold damage all through the 90s, all through until literally probably 3 years ago. So that had an effect. You know, it was almost as much the union's fault as the government's legislation fault that took our gold mine production from 650 tons to 100 tons, that took our gold mining employment from 550 down to 80. The unions played every bit as big a role as the government there. So I think 50-50, they were partners in crime, driving out gold miners, driving out mining companies. But the unions the last 3 years, they've really worked pretty well hand in hand with the mining companies. Whereas government hasn't. We see Guedi's trying to double down. Ciro's trying to double down.
That's an interesting point you make there about 550,000 employees to 80,000 employees and the trade unions perhaps seeing it as a rock bottom. So let's now start at least protecting the 80 and hopefully at some point in time we can grow it. But the government and the legislation and issues like that, I suppose that does weigh heavily. However, there are two things that are worth bearing in mind here. The one is I was at a roundtable online meeting with business leadership or Business for South Africa last week, and there were a couple of points that were made that I thought were quite hopeful. On the one, we are where we are because in developing countries, narratives matter more than facts, it appears. And we're a developing country, and the narrative around South Africa, really bad. But two, the data that was put on the table, the one was from the CEO of Toyota, who is looking after the transport cluster, as it were, for business, shows that there's been a big improvement in Transnet, and that is at least, you talked about the trend, at least the trend now finally seems to be going forward, and a similar big improvement in electricity. Not so much on crime, where Neil Vroneman, you mentioned him earlier, the criminal justice system, he's involved there. But we can't be surprised if we just watch what's happening at the Madlanga Commission. I mean, every day there's another massive shake that you wonder, how bad is this criminal syndicate that's running our country? And it's as bad as we think, it's getting worse. But at least that's being aired. So for a far-sighted mining executive, Pete, would they even start nibbling now? Would they start saying, the data's changing, the narrative isn't, the narrative's possibly getting worse, but the data definitely, it does look better on electricity and on transport, on Transnet. Would there be some brave, or who would be the brave ones who'd come in? Little companies, slightly bigger companies, possibly not the majors?
Little companies for sure, because there's a scramble for good assets. And South Africa has a lot of good assets. They're trading at big discounts from where those assets would be in most other countries. So small companies, they do come here and smell, sniff, they fly in, they visit. The local companies, they're at the forefront of taking advantage of low asset prices here, because the existing companies in this country, they're pretty well established. Their network, their modus operandi, their relationship with government, contractors, and the community. So we were really hopeful here up until the start of this year that our mid-tier companies like Mike Techie's Future Coal, like Canyon, Buslot, his Canyon Coal, and what are some of the others? Aframat, Raubex. You know, these companies have really grown the last 15, 20 years, and they're all getting involved in mining now, and not just open pit mining. You know, first of all, they just went for the bulks, iron ore and coal, but then they started looking at manganese, chrome, and boy, they've all been saying they're looking for copper, you know, and they're having to go underground now on some of these mines. So those were the upcoming mining houses. Yeah, because Anglo's is not investing here. They've been disinvesting for 30 years. Billiton, Goldfields, JCI, you know, they were broken up with the advent of the new government. And so they've been disinvesting as well, the remnants of them. So we needed the mid-tier companies to come because they had the balance sheet and they had the teams that could take closed mines and open them again, that could take greenfields projects and make them happen. Because small companies, they don't have the balance sheet, they don't have the expertise. It takes too much. And especially nowadays in mining, Alec, it's not just here. It's the whole world. Geez, it is so bureaucratic and so administrative heavy getting a mining company going. And the safety issue, I do think it's consumed many of the other divisions of mining now. I'll be shot for saying safety should ever give a passenger seat to one of the others. You know, people, that's a burn of the crucifix offense. You know, safety is supposed to be so far above all the others that all of them added together, you know, economics, job creation, return on investment, helping the shareholders, you know, pension funds, old ladies, all that's got to take such a big backseat to safety. And safety is a word used like racism. How do you prove you're not a racist? How do you prove you're not a liar or a misogynist? You know, people can put that label on you and the crowd looks at you and all of a sudden the pressure's on you to prove you're not. Well, safety is used the same way. As soon as you start querying something they've been doing that looks like overkill or unnecessary, they said, we're not going back, Peter, to killing people on the job. Just get that in your head. If anything, safety's got to get more strict. But nobody's taken the time to show how many jobs and mine openings this extreme focus on safety, you know, and it's not always on safety. It's not always well thought through. It's a legislative tool and a hammer that's got a life of its own now. And boy, nobody can argue it, or you'll just get hammered with fines or hammered with non-approvals to do things you want to do. Getting sidetracked here from the question.
No, I can understand that. But maybe let's move into a mine that is exciting. We've put it into our Ricardo portfolio. So we've got Orion Minerals there, and right on cue, the annual report was released today, and it makes good reading from an exploration company that is now transitioning into a producer. Were you happy with what you saw in the annual report, if you've had a chance to look at it yet?
Not as thoroughly as you, but I've seen a lot of the material in there for quite a few years. And hell, my comment years ago was, guys, are you trying to compete with Anglo-American here? You know, you are a little bit smaller, but it's a really, really comprehensive report. And I've been told by a couple people, insiders, Pete, what you see in that report, there's a lot more that we can't put in there because it doesn't fit in with the JORC 43101 recommendations. So that makes me smile too, Alec. And an investor should smile, because if they like what they see in that report, I believe there's a fair amount more not shown in that report that doesn't quite fulfill those very high standards that is good news for the company. So yeah, it deserves a place in your portfolio. The assets were never in doubt. And I know you had a heading from explorer, developer to miner, but the exploration bit of that company, you could kind of put a new category in between exploration and develop and call it confirmation, because a lot of that exploration they did, the majority of it was confirming what people already knew. There's huge resources in Orion. And Prieska, you have to look at when these mines close. That's always a good tip off. If you know nothing about mining and somebody brings you a project, you'd be well advised to say, okay, whatever mineral it is, I don't know much about mining. When did this project close? And get you a graph. Get a graph that goes back on the metal price that mine was producing. And get a long graph. You know, get one that goes back at least 150 years. And see when that mine closed. And if it's a gold mine and it closed in 1969 or 70, you can say, wow, they probably didn't run out of ore. You know, the gold price went flat for 40 years. So any gold mine that closed in 69, 70, he'd lasted through 38, 39 years of a flat price. Almost for sure, he wasn't out of ore. Just nobody could make money anymore. Their costs didn't allow it. Now, if a mine closed when 1979, 1980, when the gold price was $600, $700 an ounce, he probably didn't have any ore left. Well, when did Old Keep close? They closed in 2003, 2004. That is the lowest copper price in the history of man. So that alone means they probably didn't run out of ore. They just closed at the lowest ever copper price. And I think they were still breaking even then. And copper was about 60 some cents a pound. Prieska, they closed in about 1994. And that wasn't the lowest copper price in the history of man, but it was pretty close. And the zinc price was very low. And it was a zinc copper producer. So both those mines had a lot of ore known when they closed, but they were uneconomic. They were too much work for the profit they were generating. So a lot of the work Orion did was confirming, and they not only confirmed how much ore was left at the bottom of that shaft at Prieska, they confirmed there was more than twice as much ore. And they confirmed the grade was even better. Hell, Errol used to brag, we got more drill rigs going than any mine on the planet right now. I think he was right. I was out there. They had 14, 15 drill rigs going, just proving that ore block at the bottom of Prieska. So there's no ore body I know of drilled better than that, except one small ore body at Flatmine North on O'Keefe. In fact, I was worried they were going to start reducing the tonnage if they kept drilling that thing to confirm it. So, yeah, the ore's there in both those mines.
Well, so that's the good news on that side. The bad news, I suppose, is legislation in South Africa. Any threats there?
Yes. The first and foremost threat is that it's left the way it is. And I always think the government's done so much damage on policy, and they're now realizing it, that it can't possibly get worse. But we've always heard the trend is your friend until it changes. Well, policy has not changed. Gwedi has not changed. And the numbers and the talks that I've heard coming out of Cyril and Gwedi are, they are literally trying to double down. So that is the biggest risk of mining by far in South Africa. It's not even the syndicates. It's not even the construction mafia. It's not the metal price. No, it's policy. And when Rob Herzog says, let me, president, I'll turn this place around in 30 days, he could do it because my mom could almost do it from the place we're starting at right now. And yeah, that's our worry, that they say, okay, guys, we won't change policy anymore, but it's staying here. that's as big a worry than if they're going to make it worse, because it's almost so bad now that if they try to make it worse, it'll be a joke.
Well, we are seeing developments, as I say, and there's we're both super optimists. You because you're a miner, me because I'm a journalist. So I suppose you have to be on both sides. But the optimists, the long time gold bugs, are just having a rip-roaring time. Today, the American government shuts down. The gold price says, thank you, another bit of good news, $4,000. $4,000, Pete. There was a time that when you said it would get to $4,000 this year, I'm sure people looked at you and said, no, this guy's gone nuts. Are you not calling maybe $5,000 this year?
I think I'm going to reserve that call until they've broken 4,000, and I want to see how fast they break 4,000 and what happens right after. You know, does it just spike through 4 and then continue? If it continues to even 4,100, I would say the people have 5,000 in their mind. If it just goes over 4 and comes back under, I'd start holding my breath. As we said before in this program, Alec, gold had been, stuck at around 3,300 an ounce. April, May, June, July, August, and I thought, okay, that's its ceiling. There seems to be real strong buying every time it dips below there, but it's prudent buying because nobody wants to push it to 34. But since we've seen it break 34, look how quick it went, 35, 36, 37, 38. So, yeah, I'm not buying here, but I would, if I had to make a bet, I'd bet it's going to break 4 that it's not going to break 4. Yeah, so I will bet on that, but I'm too scared, too reluctant, too stubborn to buy more gold here at this, what is it, 3870?
No, it's got through 4,000, Peter, because of the American shutdown. Yeah, there we go. That's the good part of having all this technology around us, is that we can check.
My technology, Alex, quoting live, 3873.
Okay, so clearly it must have popped up there, got the headline, and then said, okay, let's get back to normal.
I think there was some finger trouble, an over-exuberant trader.
Or a headline writer, perhaps. But, let's watch that. Just before we go, perhaps you can give us your thoughts on the way that the hedge funds are buying gold as though gold shares, and in that context, this new listing in Hong Kong, the Chinese Zion, is that the way you pronounce it? Zion Mine,
it correct. I've always heard people say Zijin. You know, when we Zijin, see that V in the J and the N, we pronounce it like the English language. But yeah, I'm sure the Chinese have pronounced it different. That's not really a surprise for a few reasons. This company's been around since 93, and its founder and current chairman drove it, and he's an engineer, and he was very political. You know, it was a political appointment. It's a state-owned company, kind of like Eskom, kind of like Sasol, and it has grown and grown, and it's the largest gold producer in China. It's producing, I think, 73 tons on its own, and it wants to go to 110. It's a pretty aggressive buyer of overseas gold mines. It's bought a couple from Barrick. I'm trying to think who it bought the other one from. So it has 7 overseas gold mines that it's acquired. It's got 1 gold mine, maybe 2 in China. So they want to hive off. Their gold division's getting very large, as you can imagine. They're adding production and the market's adding the price per ounce. So they're still going to own, I think, 83%, 85% of this company. But yeah, It's going to be a listed separate company. And if you just look at the Zijin share price, that thing went flat for the last 15, 20 years. In just the last 2 years, I think it's quadrupled. You know, it's gold. And boy, could their timing be better? No, because you want to do an IPO when things are still heading up, when the people are so panicky that they're short. They're not even going to think. And you don't do it when it levels off because the buyers are already scattering. And if something's falling, there's not a buyer to be seen. So they're listing this thing at the ideal time. I think it'll be well subscribed. And boy, they're going to get $3.2 billion. They say they're going to expand and develop and pay down a little bit of the money they borrowed to buy these assets. But Zijin is in the Fortune 500. I think it's the 125th largest company. It's a Chinese Anglo-American. They produce a lot of copper, iron ore, zinc. I thought I read or heard they control 75% of the copper reserves in China. So this is a serious company, a serious mining company.
Would you be among those who are going to subscribe for the $3.2 billion in the IPO?
No, because I don't like buying after I missed the bus and it's way, way down the road, or the ship has already left the port and I have to run and jump and I know I'm not going to make it. I'll find something that hasn't moved this much, Alec.
Well, Peter Major from Modern Corporate Solutions, thank you for halving off or keeping off the jet lag for long enough to give us the benefit of your wisdom. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.